That's good. No. Let's get the whole like briefing, secret briefing. There we go. That's much better. Okay. Esteemed delegates. I'm Mr. Yuki Amano. I'm very pleased to be here at Reed College. Your professor, Montgomery, asked me to come here and give you a briefing on the current situation in Iran. I will be putting up these slides, or I will be giving them to him to put these slides up on your Moodle later on, so you do not need to take notes on all of the content. However, I do recommend that you write down questions, since this will be your last opportunity to ask the director of the IAEA about the Iranian situation. Dr. Montgomery will be back on next Thursday and Friday and Saturday for your actual negotiations. So, just to give you a bit of a background, the implementation of the NPT Safeguards Agreement in the Islamic Republic of Iran has been on the agenda of the Board of Directors of the IAEA for 8 years now and has also been on the agenda of the UN Security Council for about 5 years. Today I'm here to report to you on the outstanding issues. I will divide my presentation into 7 parts. First, I will give you an overview of the 2 main paths to nuclear weapons. Next, I will discuss Iran's nuclear facilities and how far they are along each of those 2 paths. Then I'll give you a brief overview of Iran's past failures. That is, give you some recent, some of the more recent failures. Later on, I'll give you an overview of all of the past failures prior to that. On a more hopeful note, I will discuss some recent progress that has been made. I will then review the remaining outstanding issues that the IAEA has been unable to resolve. Next, I will discuss further reading that may be helpful for you as delegates for achieving a greater understanding of the issues at stake. And then I'll conclude my hopes for this conference. Let me start with paths to the bomb. There are 2 paths to the bomb. One is highly enriched uranium, and one is plutonium. Both of them start with mining and milling uranium in order to produce what is popularly known as yellow cake, which is U-308. It is then converted from U-308, yellow cake, into one of 2 possible forms. One is uranium dioxide for use in a nuclear reactor. One is to create uranium hexafluoride, which is important because it can be, under certain temperatures and pressures, is gaseous. Since it's gaseous, it means that you can separate out the parts of the uranium you want from the part of the uranium that you don't want in order to either for power production or to produce nuclear weapons. So, uranium in its natural form, natural uranium, is 99.3% uranium-238. It is 0.7% uranium-235. Uranium-235 is the fissile part. That is what splits if you bombard it with neutrons, producing energy. If you produce it really quickly, you can have a bomb. If you produce it more slowly, it produces heat, which can be turned into electricity. Now, once you have converted it into a form which can be enriched, you can then place it in a uranium enrichment facility. There are many different ways of enriching uranium, which is, say, increasing the amount of this uranium-235. The one which is most relevant for today is by centrifuges. So these are tubes which then spin around at high velocity. You cannot chemically separate apart the uranium you like from the uranium you don't like because it's the same element. It reacts chemically the same way. What you can do is that there's a small mass difference between uranium-238 and uranium-235. So this is the fissile stuff. Uranium-235. You can use the fact that this is slightly lighter. Use different techniques for separating it. So in the centrifuges that spin around at high velocity, the lighter stuff gathers in the middle. You then suck out the uranium gas, which is slightly enriched. You put it in yet another centrifuge, which enriches it slightly more, so on and so forth. It takes on the order of thousands of centrifuges in order to produce enough highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. So typically it takes about 2,000 centrifuges working for an entire year to produce 1 bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium, which is weapons grade. There are four grades which I want you to think about. One is natural uranium, 0.7%. There is uranium for light water reactors, or LWRs, which is about 3.5%. There's highly enriched uranium for use in certain research reactors, which is about 20%. And the fourth one is weapons grade highly enriched uranium, which is about 80% plus. The higher the better. one thing I want to mention. Although it seems that most of the work here is getting from 3.5% all the way up to 80%, that's not the case. You have to think of it in this way. Suppose that you have 1,000 atoms of uranium. That means that only 7 of them are going to be uranium-235. The process of getting to highly enriched uranium means that you have to remove all of the stuff that you don't want. In order to increase about fivefold the amount of uranium, that means that you need to remove somewhere around 80% of the uranium-238. So you've done 4/5 of the work to just get it to low-enriched uranium, LEU, for use in a light water reactor or LWR. So that means that you only have 20% of the amount of work remaining to get it to weapons-grade uranium. So one of the reasons why low-enriched uranium for use in power reactors is potentially dangerous, and that it takes you a very short period of time to take it this last step. Okay. So that's one route. Mine a mill of uranium, convert it into uranium hexafluoride, put it in centrifuges, run it for a very long period of time. That gives you weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium. The second route is the plutonium route. Instead of taking your natural uranium with only 0.7% uranium-235 and attempting to enrich it, the other way which you can do it is essentially to take that natural uranium, turn it to uranium dioxide or occasionally uranium metal, fabricate it into fuel, this is a bundle of fuel rods put together, and then put it into a suitable reactor. Traditional light water power production reactors do not produce plutonium, which is very useful for nuclear weapons. You can still make a nuclear weapon out of it, but any weapons designer worth their salt is going to want to work with the good stuff, not the bad stuff. The problem is that you get this other isotope of plutonium in it, which produces too many neutrons too quickly. If you produce too many neutrons too quickly, that the bomb ends up blowing itself apart before enough of it can fission and produce a large yield, a lot of explosive power. So power production reactors, light water reactors, are not very good for that. However, heavy water reactors, like the one that Iran is building, of a certain size, which is, say, over 20 megawatts thermal. I use 20 megawatts thermal here because a 20 megawatt thermal reactor, if a gas-cooled reactor is turned on for an entire year, it produces about one bomb's worth of plutonium. So 40 is about 2 bombs worth each year. So you leave it in there for a year. You then pull out the rods, and you undergo reprocessing in a reprocessing facility. This involves chopping up fuel rods, dissolving them, and then chemically separating out the plutonium. You can do this because plutonium is chemically different than uranium. That's how you can produce plutonium. So one route, highly enriched, weapons-grade uranium. The other route is weapons-grade plutonium. Okay. With me so far? Questions? Yeah, Michael.
Is there a functional difference between uranium and plutonium?
So weapons-grade uranium can, there are two different types of nuclear weapons designs. There's the gun type and the implosion type. The gun type, you essentially take two hemispheres, or something like that, and you slam them together at high speed. You can use existing artillery technology in order to create this type of device. It's not very efficient. You need 3 times the amount of weapons-grade uranium in order to produce a bomb like that, but it's very simple. So the bomb which was dropped on Hiroshima was, in fact, a gun-type device. It was never tested. The Trinity test, which was done before, was an implosion-type device. Everyone knows that the gun-type device will work. Tested, it's very straightforward. You cannot use plutonium in a gun-type device because plutonium, even good weapons-grade plutonium, produces too many neutrons. In a gun-type device, it would blow itself apart before it got the full nuclear yield. So plutonium can only be used in an implosion-type device where you have a solid sphere of whatever it is, plutonium or uranium metal, and you set explosive charges all around it, and you set them, then you explode them all at once, which then compresses it in such a way that you get a nuclear yield. So uranium, so the United States did both routes during World War II. So it did the plutonium weapon, which was tested at Trinity Test and later dropped on Nagasaki. It also went the gun-type route with the weapon that was dropped on Hiroshima. Some countries go with high-enriched uranium, some with plutonium. Most of the first five proliferators, which is to say that the P5 members of the Security Council, United States, United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, only China used a high-enriched uranium weapon. All the rest of them used plutonium. It is technically simpler, more straightforward, to go the plutonium route in terms of the materials production. However, it is also easier to detect through intelligence means. A bunch of centrifuges in a decently sized warehouse, about the size of, say, an IKEA, would house enough centrifuges in order to be able to produce a couple of weapons each year. Whereas nuclear reactors, big, they produce a lot of isotopes which are detectable. Often they need to be cooled in some way, either with a gigantic cooling tower or they're sited close to a water supply which allow you to cool it that way, in which case the heating up of the water supply is easily detectable. So technically more difficult, but easier to sneak by other countries. Lena.
So is plutonium a product of enriching uranium?
No. It's a product of putting uranium in a nuclear reactor. So what happens in a nuclear reactor is that you have so that neutrons are fissioning the uranium-235. When an uranium-235 atom splits, it produces more neutrons, which then go on to fission more and more and more uranium-235 atoms. As a byproduct, some of those neutrons hit this uranium-238. That then turns into uranium-239, which then after a couple of processes, turns itself into plutonium. Okay, so plutonium is the byproduct of a nuclear reactor. Whereas uranium, you don't need to put it in a reactor or interact it with neutrons. You just need to try to separate out the uranium you don't want from the uranium you do want. Okay. Other questions? Spencer?
What makes a better bomb overall, or is there a difference?
Weapons designers, if pushed, tend to prefer uranium, highly enriched uranium, simply because it is less radioactive than plutonium. So it's less problematic. It is heavier. You need more highly enriched uranium than you need plutonium. So if you're looking to make a particularly small weapon, you might want to use plutonium instead of highly enriched uranium. But uranium is generally the easier material to work with, which isn't to say that it's easy to create any kind of nuclear weapon, but it is easier to work with uranium than it is with plutonium. Other questions? All right. Talk about Iran's facilities. Iran has a number of facilities and has made a significant amount of progress towards having enough fissile materials that they could make it into a nuclear weapon. This map here indicates the different countries which have assisted Iran in various different parts of its nuclear facilities. Maybe surprised that the U.S. is one of these countries. This is back in the late 60s when we gave a research reactor to Iran, which is located in Tehran. Argentina's here on the map because they provided additional fuel loads to Iran after the revolution when the U.S. would no longer give them enough. Nonetheless, it is a small enough research reactor that it is not big enough to produce enough plutonium for nuclear weapons. However, the fuel it runs on is not natural uranium, not even low-enriched uranium, but it's this 20% high-enriched uranium, which means that Iran has an excuse for producing 20% high-enriched uranium, because, of course, it's for this reactor that we have. It couldn't possibly be that we're hedging against the possibility of taking that 20% high-enriched uranium and later turning it into weapons-grade uranium and using it in a nuclear weapon. No, it's all for the reactor. So Iran has one operating nuclear reactor power plant at Bushehr. It says 2009 is actually completed and began operations in 2011. It is a 1,000 megawatt electric reactor. There's a distinction between megawatts thermal, megawatts electric, that the efficiency of turning thermal energy, heat produced by nuclear reactors, into electricity, it's only about one-third. So this is actually a 3,000 megawatt thermal, approximately, reactor, which is then produces a much smaller amount of electricity. Russia built the Bushehr reactor. It was originally supposed to open in 1999, so it's about 12 years late on that. They have a second reactor, which Iran has announced that they're building at Darkhoven, which sounds much more ominous than it probably is. It's going to be a 360-megawatt electric reactor, and they're building it from an indigenous design. In theory, it'll open in 2019. In practice, who knows? Most nuclear reactors are built not at all on time and massively over budget anywhere. They're also building a heavy water reactor here at Iraq. It's supposed to open in 2014. I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. Nonetheless, it is a 40-megawatt thermal reactor, which, of course, is problematic because you can produce about 2 nuclear weapons a year. It's also problematic because heavy water reactors have this design whereby you can load and unload them while they're operating, so it's somewhat easier to sneak things in or out without the rest of the world knowing what's going on. They're also going to be building some sort of a reprocessing facility. Plans for that have not yet been submitted to the IAEA, so who knows what it's going to be or when it's going to exist. Ostensibly, this reactor is for medical isotope production. Now, one of the key differences is that is telling whether a reactor is for medical isotope production or whether it is for creating nuclear weapons is the type of reprocessing facility. To produce medical isotopes, you put targets around or sometimes in the reactor in order to irradiate them with neutrons. You then pull the targets out and extract the isotopes for use in medical services. The shielding for this is pretty minimal because the targets are not very radioactive. On the other hand, if you are building a facility in order to reprocess plutonium, which means you actually pull the entire rods out and try to reprocess those require much more shielding because they are highly radioactive. In fact, they require leaded glass windows that are meters thick. It's all done by remote manipulators. There's not somebody just kind of going in and chopping it up with a knife and, you know, doing a little chemistry. It's all remote. Which is why it was suspicious back in 2003 when Iran was trying to place orders for meters thick leaded glass rather than facilities that would be more appropriate for medical isotope production. Now, Iran also has mining and milling facilities at Bandar Abbas and Yazd. They have a conversion facility at Esfahan, which takes in the uranium from these sources and then turns it into uranium hexafluoride. They also have a fuel production facility here, which is just getting up and running now, which can produce fuel for either of these two reactors, the Iraq heavy water one or the Tehran research reactor. Now, the two facilities that are of most concern, at least right now, until the heavy water reactor starts up, are the two enrichment facilities. Now, it takes very few centrifuges, well, if a couple thousand is few, in order to produce in a year enough highly enriched weapons-grade uranium to produce a nuclear weapon. It takes tens of thousands of these to produce enough low-enriched uranium in order to use it in a nuclear power plant. So at Natanz, which is one of the facilities, they are planning 54,000 centrifuges. This up here says SWU, that's separative work units. There are some centrifuges which are more efficient, which are less. As it turns out, around centrifuges are rated at about 1 SWU, so 1 centrifuge is 1 SWU. Don't worry about that too much. Read these as being centrifuges instead of SWU. Of that, they have installed about 9,200 of them, of which 8,800 are operating. They have already produced about 4,500 kilograms of low-enriched uranium, about 3.5%. That is enough low-enriched uranium that if you took all that and ran it again through the centrifuges in a couple of months, then you would produce about 2 to 4 nuclear weapons worth of weapons-grade uranium. They have also produced about 100 kilograms of 20% enriched, highly enriched uranium. Not weapons-grade, mind you, but highly enriched. It takes about 180 kilograms of highly enriched uranium in order to produce enough weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium in order to put it into a bomb. So they don't have quite enough of the 20% stuff in order to make a bomb. They need to double it, roughly. Now, there's a second facility, which is the one which the world is particularly concerned about, and that this one is clearly designed, at least this amount of capacity more or less fits the idea that they would mine uranium, convert it, enrich it, and then send it to Boucher. The second facility is built underneath a mountain for the purposes of keeping anyone from bombing it. Not because it's convenient to stick things under mountains. This one is only planned to have about 3,000 SWU, about 3,000 centrifuges. They may put more efficient centrifuges in there later. They've installed about 600 already, and they've produced 14 kilograms of highly enriched uranium at this facility. Let me just mention briefly that one of the concerns, at least in the press, is that this particular facility will be impossible to attack using conventional means. This is only if one is particularly unimaginative and simply tries to bomb something. However, there are multiple ways of defeating a facility. For example, you could bomb the entrance so that they can't get in or out of it. That's a very effective way of keeping a facility from being used, in that there are only a couple ways in and out of these facilities. Or you could have special forces go in and attempt to destroy it from inside as well. So, you can see why the world may be concerned about all of the different capacities which Iran is building. And while they do not have, as far as the world knows, any weapons-grade highly enriched uranium, they have not diverted uranium from anything, they have the capability now of producing weapons-grade highly enriched uranium in a matter of months. And we mentioned that the IAEA is set up for the purposes of ensuring that what countries say that they're doing is in fact what they're doing. So it's designed to detect diversion. It's not designed to detect random facilities which are built somewhere else in the country. So Iran says, we dug up this amount of uranium, we then did the following things to it, and this is what we've produced. The IAEA, given that information, taking some samples, as they are currently, can say, yes, in fact, that matches up with what we have observed. IAEA does not have independent intelligence assets which can determine that there's some other randomly located facility which Iran is doing work on. Member states have to produce that kind of intelligence for the IAEA to act. Let me just give you one quick graph to give you an idea of the centrifuge trends at Natanz. So this is from about February 07 all the way through November of 2011. Which the black parts indicate centrifuges which are operating, and the green ones indicate ones which are installed but not operating yet. See, that's a fairly consistent increase. The Stuxnet virus, which was designed particularly to deactivate it, took out about 1,000 centrifuges. You can see the drop off here in the graph. What is interesting, in part, is that while Iran started out on what looks like this roughly linear installation schedule, this then is leveled off. This may indicate that they're having difficulty in producing the different parts for centrifuges. Iran has chosen as a number of centrifuges, which are based on Pakistani designs. They have the Pakistani designs, the P1 and the P2. Iran has imaginatively renamed them the IR1 and the IR2. Both of these are mid-range technologies, which is one reason why Iran may not be doing this faster. They're not the simplest possible centrifuges, which would be a more efficient way of producing enriched uranium. Instead, they are technologies which require a good bit of tweaking to work properly. So the IR2, for example, uses a particular type of alloy called mar-aging steel, which is very difficult to produce. Only a few countries can produce it in the world. Iran currently cannot. So they, in fact, have to import the tubes for that. So that's one weakness of it. The other one, the IR1, is a supercritical centrifuge. What this means is that it spins fast enough that it passes through a frequency where it tends to shake itself apart. Any taken physics? Resonance frequencies? Okay, all right, good. Ellen, you're done with this. So they have to be tweaked in certain ways to make it through those resonances. Essentially, they cut it in half, and they produce this sort of joint in the middle, and that allows it to go through those frequencies. Nonetheless, however, this particular type of centrifuge is also known to be highly delicate. Some people refer to centrifuges as self-disassembling machines because they do, because if, and in fact, they crash. And if they crash, Then one of them spinning around gets off its axis a little bit, then it can take out other centrifuges. So not something you want to be around if things go wrong. Sorry, are there any questions about facilities? Yeah.
Elena? Was the reactor given by the United States to Iran supposed to be a four bomb?
Mm. It was. It's just a research reactor, not unlike Reed's research reactor for. I mean, I don't think that they take undergrads and have them put dimes in there to irradiate them, but it's for basic research and very low level production of medical isotopes. So.
And what medical uses are there?
There are various different types of radioactive sources which are used, some of them for X-ray, some of them for radiation therapy. So for example, cesium-137 is frequently used for X-rays. X-ray machines essentially are a radioactive source sitting inside a box. They remove the shielding, you get some X-rays, they then close the shielding again, it then exposes some photographic film, which is then developed. It's not that they can magically, the X-rays are being produced all of the time. Not that sort of goes on and off. Cesium-137, by the way, is a very effective thing to use for a dirty radiological bomb. Please don't go and do that. Michael?
So given what we know about Iran's current technology, it would be impossible for them to just build like an IKEA and then put centrifuges in it, like secretly Iran.
No, but that would be a very good disguise for it.
Well, so like they wouldn't currently be able to build any new facilities without us knowing about them.
Well, it's not clear. The existing facilities were discovered independently through a number of different intelligence operations, some of it signals intelligence, that is to say detecting, you know, conversations between people, some of it image intelligence, watching different sites, which we think are likely military sites, some of it through human intelligence that leaks from various people who think that it might, that well, this is not suspicious that this is. So it's possible that if they tried to create a new facility that it would be detected through various different types of means, but it's not by any means definitive that we would be able to do that. So. Helen?
So is there a reason why they chose second-rate Pakistani centrifuge design? Like, is there some sort of conflict?
Right, so... That's a good question. It's in part because they were offered them, and it seemed like a good way of getting a jump on it instead of trying to develop centrifuge technologies from scratch. That the AQ Khan network promised working centrifuges, which they could, and then designs for more. The downside of this is that because these are sensitive machines, and because Pakistan was essentially getting rid of all of their old centrifuges. I mean, think of the AQ Khan network as a used car salesman. Oh yeah, low miles. Grandmother used to enrich uranium in her garage or something.
Okay.
Not at all the broken ones which we don't want anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, I mean, in some sense, they ended up on a suboptimal technological trajectory. Because it seemed like they could steal a march and everything. It would have been smarter to just to sit down and say, okay, what are our requirements? What is the lowest tech way we can possibly do this? There are various advanced arguments about this having to do with regime type and bureaucratic competence and things like that, for which you can take my nuclear politics class. Spencer?
You mentioned that these Pakistani centrifuges self-dismantling, they tend to crash.
Yes.
Can they be made to crash either mechanically or electronically/digitally?
Yes, that was what the Stuxnet was intended to do, was to speed them up and slow them down in certain ways. It was to move them repeatedly through the resonance frequency in an attempt to get them to blow apart. Or to pull them down to such a low frequency that the gyroscopic stabilization, which is supposed to occur in spinning things, it gets destabilized and crashed that way. So either too fast or too slow are both difficult, are both risky stages for centrifuges.
And what about mechanically, as in like people themselves? Can people themselves make them crash inside
Oh, what do you mean? Like, if you want to hit it with a wrench?
Like, if someone were to mess with the dials?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all computer controlled, so there's not dials per se. But yes, if you were to have a saboteur who was able to directly reprogram them instead of having to have a virus to do it, then it might work. So, also, if you drop large bombs in the facility, that also tends to make them crash. So, Sanders, you have a question?
I was just going to ask if you knew what the power level on the Tehran research was. I was just curious.
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
It's low.
I'll look it up.
I don't know if it's bigger. I think it's bigger than Reed's reactor.
Oh,
but
definitely by far. But I'm just wondering, you know, how it compares to the largest research reactor we have.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Lena, was that a...
Nope.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Let's talk about some recent failures. So, back in January of 2009, when this facility, which is in a mountain near Qom, now called the Fordo Fuel Enrichment Plant, which Iran had not reported on to anyone, it was discovered that in 2009 there was a lot of excavation going on, that there were clear entrances into the tunnels going into the mountain in this facility, which by September 2009 they tried to cover up the tunnel entrances in order to obscure that any work had been going on there at all. So, some problems with this. Even though it was apparent that work had been done in this particular area in 2002, 2004, and 2006, even though Iran claimed to have only allocated it to the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, or AEOI, in the second half of 2007. So that's somewhat suspicious, since they were doing all this work ahead of time. It's designed to have 3,000 IR1 centrifuges. They are now talking about upgrading these to even more efficient ones. More importantly, they are in violation of Code 3.1 of the Safeguards Agreements, which they signed with the IAEA. Code 3.1, which is standard among all countries, specifies that you need to submit Design Information Verification, or DIV, evidence to the IAEA prior to building facilities, not after you've built them underneath the mountain very quietly. So this is just a recent failure of Iran to report things. Before I give you a full list of all of the things which the AAA would like from Iran, let me also mention there's been some recent progress. September 2011, Ahmadinejad. I should forget how to pronounce it. It's Ahmadinejad. That's the mnemonic. Offered to stop producing 20% enriched uranium if the West were to supply new fuel loads for the Tehran research reactor. And more recently, February 15th, Iran agreed to take part in six-party talks. France, Germany, UK, China, Russia, and the US, which is, say, the permanent five, the P5 plus Germany. Furthermore, even more recently, on March 6th, Iran said that, well, the IAEA can visit one particular facility at Parchin. Parchin is a military base in which it is suspected that Iran has been carrying out, or has in the past carried out, experiments having to do with explosive lenses, which is to say, implosion, right? Trying to get an explosion to crush uranium or plutonium. And they have refused all access to Parchin prior to this, and recently said, well, all right, we'll let you make one visit. You can go one time only to it, and that's it, because, well, it's a sensitive facility, and we don't want our military secrets leaking out. However, there are a large number of outstanding issues, enough that I almost had to create a second slide in order to fit all of them on. This is what the IAEA is talking about. There are maybe other demands in addition to this that some certain countries may want. First of all, the Iranians have rolled back their safeguards agreement, which they signed sometime in the 90s. They rolled all the way back to their 1976 safeguards agreement. This is long before any of you were born. I can't say, well, if you recall 1976, but if you could recall 1976, you would know that the status of nuclear technology was relatively primitive at that time relative to now. Back in 1976, you did not have to supply design information verification You only had to give the blueprints for a facility when you were about to introduce nuclear material into it. So you can build it and then let people know right before you introduce any uranium into it. Now, not only does the IAEA, and Iran is the only country with any significant nuclear facilities that does not provide this type of information under Code 3.1, the design information verification. The IAEA would like Iran to comply with the additional protocol. Additional protocol Iran actually signed in 2003 and briefly committed to comply with it. What it does on top of all of the regular IAEA inspectors come in, they have some cameras, they take some sample, they determine whether you have been doing what you say you've been doing. Additional protocol means that given 24-hour notification, they can go anywhere in the country if they get some sort of intelligence from a member country that is actionable in some way. So there's some new facility, the IAEA can demand, we want to be taking that facility so we can take samples, so we can determine that you are not, in fact, trying to divert uranium, produce nuclear weapons, what have you. Now, the IAEA would also like Iran to clarify a number of things. First one is this uranium metal document, which described a technique for machining uranium into hemispheres. Now, unless Iran is going to start a nuclear bowling league, solid uranium metal hemispheres are only useful for one thing, which is to say nuclear weapons. It's not a particularly useful form in any other sense than that. Let's see. Moreover, let's see what else. Okay, so second, there are a number of issues which the IAEA is concerned about procurement and production by military-related industries, particularly ones which have links to the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps. This includes, among many other things, attempts by that organization to source uranium that would be entirely outside of the safeguard agreements. So if you recall, under regular safeguard agreements, they have to account for all the flow of uranium through all the different steps. This was an attempt to acquire uranium outside of those steps and therefore outside of the IAEA safeguards. Third, the agency has also had concerns about activities related to Iran's development of weapons delivery systems, particularly a re-engineering of the payload chamber, let's say the nose cone on the Shahab-3 ballistic missile. Now, there are a number of different aspects of intelligence which the IAEA has received about this re-engineering of the top of the missile, which includes certain mass and dimensions, high voltage generator box, set with an airburst trigger, multiple detonators, 400-millimeter test shaft for testing whatever mysterious thing is going to be put inside this nose cone. And when the IAEA looked at it and graded all of these characteristics, as in, you know, is it likely that this particular type of device, is it possible is orange, unlikely is yellow, and impossible is green? It turns out that for a nuclear weapon, that all of these lined up perfectly, whereas any other types of payloads, not that these other payloads are necessarily good, it's not like biological and chemical weapons are A-OK. Nonetheless, it doesn't match up with chemical high explosives, EMP, electromagnetic pulse. It certainly doesn't match up with a satellite launch, but it matches up perfectly with nuclear. By the way, this attachment is included, and I encourage you to read this in a 10-page annex, which is at the end of the latest report which I have written, which is linked to on the website. It will give you an idea of all of the things which the IAEA would like to know about regarding Iran's activities. There are a variety of other types of weaponization activities which Iran has also carried out, or at least including different types of research into high explosives, types of detonators, which would be particularly useful for nuclear weapons, so on and so forth. Third part has to do with compliance, existing compliance, as opposed to some issues which we've seen in the past and present, which seem to be important. First one, suspending enrichment. Currently, Iran continues to enrich uranium. The IAEA and the UN Security Council has demanded that Iran stop this enrichment. Second, the suspending construction of the heavy water reactor and the Fordo fuel enrichment plant. Iran continues to construct both of those. The IAEA would like access to the heavy water plant. So in addition to producing a heavy water reactor, you need a supply of heavy water. There's a plant right next to it, which they're constructing, and the IAEA would like access and has yet to get access to that plant. Finally, the IAEA would like access to the Parchin site, and not just simply on this one-time basis, but it needs to do if we need to do follow-up observations, we'd like full access to it. Questions about these? It's all in the report. Let me recommend some further reading for you. This is not the most recent report. This report in November 2011. I highly recommend this one because it is extensive, covers pretty much everything you would need to know in prior reports, includes a 10-page annex. It's quite a page-turner. The implementation of the MPT Safeguards Agreement and relevant provisions of Security Council resolutions in the Islamic Republic of Iran. I've written a series of these reports. There's about 30 of them going back 8 years. This is the most important one to read. I also highly recommend that you read the UN Security Council Resolution 1929. This is the most recent of four resolutions passed by the Security Council, which put increasing degrees of economic sanctions on Iran and may give you an idea of certain types of solutions, language, or other things which might come out of your diplomatic conference.
Are those on
the Moodle? There. They're linked to on the Moodle. There is a link on the Moodle called Simulation Research Links, includes links to various websites, links to countries, whole thing. All the materials which I used in this presentation will also be up there when I get back to my office and put it up. All right, in conclusion, so as I've indicated in the past, all the nuclear material declared by Iran to the agency has been accounted for, and apart from the small quantities previously reported to the board, there have been no further findings of undeclared nuclear material. So we haven't found them with any additional material. But because we've been unable to resolve these past outstanding issues relevant to the scope and nature of Iran's current and past centrifuge enrichment program, the agency cannot make any further progress in its efforts to provide assurances about the absence of undeclared nuclear material and activities in Iran. It continues to be a matter of serious concern. I remain hopeful that, through an ongoing dialogue between Iran, European, and other partners, that the conditions can be created a long-overdue negotiation that aims to achieve a comprehensive settlement that, on the one hand, addresses the international community's concerns about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, while, on the other hand, addressing Iran's economic, political, and security concerns. We are most grateful to Reed College for allowing us to use their facilities for this important diplomatic conference, and feel that it is doubly appropriate due to Reed's research reactor program, which demonstrates the peaceful uses of nuclear technology. I wish you the best of luck. Questions? Someone can turn the lights back on.
Is Iran complying with the IAEA at all, just because they're afraid of the retaliation?
Well, I cannot speculate on the motives of Iran complying with it, although it is generally thought in diplomatic circles that were Iran to pull out of the NPT, or to act as such, which is to say to kick out all of the inspectors, that it might be likely that various countries might wish to carry out certain strikes against some of those facilities. So, yes, I suspect that the threat of force is important here. Spencer?
On the threat of force, regarding the facility in Qom, if there were a strike there in the mountain facility, what would the risk be to the surrounding populace? I know it's a major city there.
It is, but it's far enough away that it's not of major concern. Uranium itself is not very radioactive. Mm-hmm. It's not a... You know, I mean, it's not something you want hanging around. And radon, which is a major concern for homeowners, which seeps to the basement, is actually is the result of radioactive decay of uranium. Nonetheless, uranium in and of itself, especially after it's separated from other things, is not it's not a major problem. The stuff that you really want to worry about are fuel rods after they've been irradiated in a reactor. Because that contains lots of nasty fission products. So strikes on nuclear reactors which are operating or on spent fuel ponds are ones which would be potentially hazardous to... So it would be, for example, very hazardous to attack Bushehr. Yeah, really?
Where do they dispose of the nuclear rods after they use them?
No one has figured out the answer to that question. There are some countries that are some way towards figuring that out. The U.S., for a long time, was going to bury it in Nevada, in Yucca Mountain. The Obama administration decided that that was not a terrific idea, so the answer is, well, we're still looking for one. There's some, I think, Sweden, somewhere, has more or less figured it out, or at least no one seems to be currently objecting to it. But it's an unsolved problem generally for nuclear power generation. So, sorry?
So shoot them into space.
So... Yeah, the problem with shooting radioactive waste into space is that by the time you put enough shielding around the waste, if the launch goes wrong, and many launches do go wrong, the amount of waste which you can shoot into outer space is so small that by the time you shot it into outer space, you will have entirely depleted the ozone layer. Yes. Neither can you grind it up and put it in the oceans, although that has also been considered. Yes, like sort of fish food. In theory, that could work. So there's essentially, if you have something nasty, whether it's chemicals, biological waste, nuclear waste, there are two solutions. Either you put it all together and then you try to contain it, or you spread it out so much that the small amounts of it which get into whatever are not terribly important. In theory, this could work in the oceans, except the ocean tends to concentrate things in hot spots, which could then lead to problems. So you know about the Great Garbage Patch?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
There's seven of them. Did you know that?
Are they all bigger than Texas?
No.
It also depends on the density. I mean, it is bigger than Texas in that the one Great Garbage Patch, like that, there's a lot of stuff in that area. It's not one solid thing the size of Texas. It's just that there's a bunch of stuff floating around in there, which is very distinctive if you sail through. Answer.
So that's why, it's like Bisher, you said, is vulnerable, and it's close enough to like metropolitan areas that it would be damaging not just the environment, but you know, there would be high loss of life if there were a strike there.
I don't know. It depends on prevailing winds, a lot of other variables, but it would be an unwise thing to attack,
right.
Especially since the reactor grade, until Iran has a plutonium separation facility capable of separating out rods that are in a civilian nuclear reactor, which has plutonium, which you wouldn't want anyway, there's no particular point in bombing Bushehr. Which doesn't say that it hasn't been done multiple times in the past. Iraq bombed it, U.S., let's see.
Iraq bombed it during the war?
Iraq bombed it, yes. It was originally going to be built by the Germans in the late 70s. The Germans pulled out. After the revolution, the Russians said, we'll fix it, or we'll complete it, and basically, it more or less had to start over from scratch because it's an entirely different reactor design. So, Maya?
Is there a way to tell how much their productivity would increase if they replaced their centrifuges?
Yeah, so the IR2, if it works, if they can get enough of them, is about twice as efficient. No one quite knows what the IR4 is, so it's difficult or impossible to speculate as to how much better that would be. But yeah, they would be able. But see, at this point, in order to do the additional enrichment, wouldn't really take them that long, even with the not very efficient IR1, aka P1 centrifuges. Yeah, yeah.
What exactly is involved in manufacturing heavy water?
It's separation. So heavy water is deuterium. Which is, so most water is hydrogen, which is just a single proton. Deuterium is a proton and a neutron together, so it's heavier. That is to say that it's heavy hydrogen. Now, the oxygen makes up most of the weight of it, so if it's not like heavy water isn't like, whoa, it's twice as heavy. It's like 5% heavier, roughly. And it's expensive. Once again, because you have to separate it out through mass differences, it's time-consuming and electricity-consuming and expensive. So, almost no one uses them for power production except for Canada, who has a lot of electricity left over from its hydro, and so it uses that to separate heavy water to put in other power plants to then run nuclear. I don't know exactly what the logic is, so. But that's the causal chain. Yeah, Sarah.
Both the heavy water reactor they're potentially building and Bushehr could create the fuel odds that would have plutonium that then would be separated. It doesn't have to just be a heavy water reactor to make it, or
no, but the heavy water reactor produces weapons grade plutonium, whereas the Bushehr just produces reactor grade plutonium, which could be used for a weapon, but no one would want to use it. So for example, if you use reactor grade plutonium instead of weapons grade plutonium, if it had been used in the device dropped on Nagasaki, then you would have gotten 1 kiloton yield instead of 20, which is much smaller, still nothing you would want to be anywhere near. So you could use the same design to swap out the plutonium. So if you want a nuclear arsenal, you want the weapons grade, but in a pinch, the reactor grade will do. All right. Anything else? Okay, so I'm not here Monday or Wednesday, so just come here, then meet with your countries. You may want to go off somewhere else if you are having secret discussions of some kind or another. Remember, for Thursday, Western business attire. Okay. I encourage all of you to go to see Sagan, Nuclear Power Without Nuclear Proliferation, at 4:30 as well. And I further encourage you to show up in your Western business attire, because that would be funny. All right. Don't forget, next Tuesday is when you need to email your memos to your delegation chairs and heads of state.
Next Tuesday is what?
Third.
My mom, actually, she went to school with George Bush, and they were, like, discussing what to do with the leftover uranium.
Yeah.
And she was, he said that we should put it into
the water. We should what?
We should put it into the water.
We'll just forever float our nuclear waste.
Yeah.